Item number one, what the weather has to do with economic growth. Item number two, French fries and coffee milkshakes. Item number three, hey, come on, put down that cell phone when you're walking, will ya? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 30th of July today, summertime, that is, which figures prominently in today's A-List Economic Report Gross Domestic Product. We got this morning our first look at overall economic growth in the second quarter, an acceptable but not great 2.3% annualized growth rate. More significant, though, was an update to the first quarter numbers, that is January through March, otherwise known as, yes, winter. Growth there was revised up from -0.2% to 0.6% worth of positive growth. The numbers aren't really the important part. I probably shouldn't even have mentioned them. What matters is how the government worked the first quarter numbers, how it made what are known as seasonal adjustments to them. Marketplace's Mark Garrison starts us off.
Break GDP down, and I mean all the way down, and you have regular people buying and selling stuff. Bob Capace owns Worthington Jewelers in Central Ohio.
Normally, we're going to do about double in December what we would do in January.
Of course, he doesn't panic every January when his jewelry business drops because he knows sales peak for the holidays. He adjusts, so he's comparing apples to apples. Economists do something similar looking at economic activity, which also slows in winter. Peterson Institute senior fellow Justin Wolfers explains.
We want to know, relative to other winters, how well is the economy doing? That's what seasonal adjustment does.
Wolfers and others have recently been asking questions about consistently weak first quarter numbers. Beth Ann Bovino is U.S. Chief Economist for Standard & Poor's.
Over the last several years, we've noticed that estimates seem to be underestimating the first quarter GDP regularly.
This is where it's important to remember that GDP is not just cold numbers cranked out by machine. Humans tell the computers how to crunch the numbers. One of them is Nicole Meyerhauser at the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis, which puts out the GDP.
We wanted to dig into those patterns and start to see if we could find anything.
They did. How they reacted is complicated, but a key change is how they account for defense spending. Today's adjusted numbers are among the highest profile new moves in the maddening quest to answer the question, how are we doing?
It's a continuation of an approach that we're constantly pursuing, which is making sure we are seasonally adjusting the data as best we can.
Whether you're selling engagement rings or measuring the whole economy, you need to look at your data carefully so you know when to freak out. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Gotta know when to freak out. All right, so you got your systemic economic growth, GDP and all that, like Mark was just talking about. And then you've got your corporate economic growth, vis-a-vis tech companies in particular for us today. Facebook reported profits after the bell yesterday, took a bit of a hit today share price-wise, but revenues were up, as was its user base, both good things. Twitter and Yelp were definitely not so fortunate. Both tallied big disappointments on the growth charts. So Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more now on Wall Street's obsession with corporate growth.
Not to be too dramatic about it, but if you're a tech company, it's pretty much grow or die. Kara Sprague is a partner at McKinsey & Company.
Growth is actually the most important thing, especially for companies that are small.
By small, she means under $4 billion a year in revenue. Twitter at less than $2 billion still counts as small. And when she talks about growth, she means explosive growth. Consider this.
If you're a healthcare company and you're achieving 20% growth in revenue, everybody would be ecstatic.
But if you're a tech company, 20% growth could mean it's time to call the undertaker.
That is actually a very low number. And in many cases, that means that the company won't be around in several years.
If a tech company does manage to survive to corporate adulthood, like 11-year-old Facebook, astronomical growth gets harder and harder. Alan Peltz-Sharp is an analyst at 451 Research. He says investor focus really should be on something else.
But at the end of the day, it should be on revenue and profit, and it isn't.
But the obsession with a tech company's growth sticks around.
How many clicks, how many users, how many subscribers?
That keeps companies throwing money at new users, new markets, worrying less about the bottom line today in order to stay alive tomorrow. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
In keeping with our theme, there was some growth on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The European migrant crisis seems to have come to a head in Calais, France, where as many as 2,000 people a night are trying to get through the Channel Tunnel over to England. The BBC's Zoe Conaway talked with some of them near the Eurotunnel freight terminal.
We're just walking into the woods where some migrants have got a campfire that they're sat around. What's your name?
Karim.
Where are you from?
Syria.
Syria. Tell me, are you planning to try and go to England tonight?
Yes, every night we try to get to England. Some people like not even slept here, been just one day and get through.
And will you try and jump on a train?
Of course. What I'm here for.
What's your name?
Fatima.
Fatima. Fatima, where are you from in Syria?
Aleppo.
Aleppo. You're pregnant. How many months pregnant are you?
5.
Well, I'm now following Karim across the field. He's taking me to the fence to show me where he thinks he might be able to cross tonight.
We go to this jungle. You see this little jungle here between the water, the little river. We hide in there and the spot is in front of it. We got through there.
What you're planning to do is dangerous.
In Syria, it's worse and worse. Like, you sleep, you don't know when your house is going to blow up on you. This is nothing.
Well, we're just going down a ditch through some long grasses, walking along the perimeter fence. So there are 20 men standing in a line. I can see, in fact, one woman in front of me. And there's a very large hole in the fence that they can walk through. I mean, it's perhaps about 5 foot high, and they're walking through it to get to the next fence, which they're now having to jump over to get onto the tracks. And there's a break in the razor wire. One of them has literally just made it over. He's just thrown his jacket onto the wire so that the others can use it to help them so they don't hurt themselves as they cross over. It looks like the police have arrived. I can see a blue flashing light, so everyone's now crouching down onto the ground so that the police don't see them.
Let's go to the road. Let's go to the road.
The migrants are now moving away from the hole. Excuse me, you're from Eritrea?
Yes.
Are you going to try and cross tonight?
Yeah.
How many times have you tried?
Every night.
And how old are you? Sorry to be rude, but how old are you? 16. Okay.
16.
Okay. The police disappeared just a couple of minutes ago. It's about midnight, and there are now a group of migrants back by the hole in the fence. Pretty extraordinary, really, how brazen this is. Well, it's now past 1 o'clock in the morning. The police are trying to move people away from the fence, but as you can hear, they don't want to go. There's real frustration here.
Why tomorrow? Today?
The word is that about 70 migrants managed to get over the fence, this stretch of fence anyway. One of the people that didn't make it across, though, is Karim. So, Karim, the train's going past and you're not on it.
Yes, I know, because I'm not lucky. When I get lucky, I'll be on it.
Tonight's not your night.
Yeah, you still don't know that. Maybe later.
So you might still try?
Yes, every day, every night. We're still trying. You can see the police closing the hole, but there'll be 100 holes again. People are so desperate to get to England, we'll never give up.
Zoe Conaway there from our partner broadcasters at the BBC. She was in Calais, France. The American labor market is a cumbersome beast. 157 million of us, plus or minus, that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. People join in and leave the workforce with varying degrees of regularity, as we tell you the first Friday of every month when the unemployment numbers come out. One group, though, is disproportionately not leaving the workforce, which is creating problems farther down the demographic curve. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on baby boomers who just keep on working.
It's the Woodstock generation, born during and after World War II, who are supposed to be retired already or retiring soon. At 79, attorney Martin Kramer fits the bill. He was actually at Woodstock. He was one of the festival's lawyers. The New York law firm he worked for represented artists like Jimi Hendrix.
I remember clearly Lieutenant Governor Malcolm Wilson was in charge, and he wanted to send in the National Guard in uniform. And I said, 33-year-old me, to his chief of staff, I said, if he does that, I'll sue all you guys.
I'm sitting out on the deck with Kramer at his country house in upstate New York, where he's vacationing. More than four decades after Woodstock, with Kramer pushing 80, you'd think he might be on kind of permanent vacation, but actually he's still working as a lawyer down in New Jersey 3 or 4 days a week. Not quite as exciting as Woodstock, mostly wills and estates.
I realize I do it because I enjoy it. I need the intellectual stimulation. I need something to keep me actively occupied.
Labor force participation rate for people 55 and over is basically as high as we've seen in a couple of generations.
That's economist Matthew Rutledge at the Boston College Center for Retirement Research. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the percentage of people over 55 who are working or looking for work has increased by one-third in the last 25 years.
People are responding to the fact that they're going to live longer and that therefore they have more years that they have to cover.
Plus, the recession and slow recovery mean many seniors have even less to work with.
The Social Security benefits aren't going to be replacing their income at the rates that they used to in previous generations. People's pensions aren't as generous as they used to be in all likelihood. People just haven't saved all that much. Housing prices falling, as we've seen during the recession.
71-year-old Bill Safier can relate to that. I met him working out at his gym.
Spinal twist.
In 2008, he was downsized out of a senior management job in healthcare. Now he's trying to make it as an independent consultant.
There's creative juices that I still have to work out, and that means working.
Kind of icing on the cake, or is this really food on the table? And I know that's a hard question, a personal question.
But I don't know. My wife and I had a discussion yesterday on this very issue. I had a small cushion, and it is running down. My wife wants me to retire. But I really can't. We can't afford it.
Kyle Pierce thought she'd be free and clear of needing to work when she retired from nursing at age 62.
I played bridge a lot of the time.
I reached her at home in Massachusetts as she and her husband were getting ready to host a bridge party. But she's not just playing cards these days. She says through the recession, returns on her savings went way down.
I realized that we were going in the hole to the tune of about $1,000 a month. I figured I'd better start doing something. And I had been a waitress way back, and I thought, well, let me do that. And went from $42 an hour as a nurse to $11.
But if Martin Kramer keeps doing wills and estates into his 80s, Bill Safier and Kyle Pierce are still working well into their 70s, won't that crowd out all the young people coming up behind? Apparently not. Economist Matthew Rutledge calls this the lump of labor fallacy.
That there's only a certain amount of jobs out there, and if an old person's holding that job, that means a young person isn't.
In fact, he says the opposite is true.
Old people working is good for the economy. And when old people are working instead of being retired, they have a lot more money to spend.
Not everyone agrees that older workers holding onto their jobs for decades more will be a boon to the young. But either way, it's a reality employees and employers will have to deal with for a long time to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this whole thing that we're sitting in front of was a complete and total accident, really and truly.
But I'll tell you what, the burgers are really good. The CEO of Shake Shack, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 5 points today, less than a 0.1%, closed at 17,745. The NASDAQ gained 17 points, about a 0.3%, 5128. The S&P 500 up less than a point, basically flat, 2108. Procter & Gamble off 4%. The consumer products giant behemoth, you may well say, posted disappointing sales figures and said the strong dollar hit its overseas businesses. Rival Colgate-Palmolive dipped 1.33%. Second quarter profits also took a hit from the strong dollar. Facebook off 1.8%. We told you a little bit about that. Expenses apparently grew faster than revenues did. Whole Foods off 11.6%. Let me say that again, 11.6%. Sales growth slowed sharply last month. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its final July consumer sentiment survey. Lollapalooza gets underway in Chicago. Prohibited items include hammocks, fireworks, and drones. And something else you may see if you glance toward the sky, we're in for a blue moon. That's when a full moon occurs for the second time in the same month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a report out earlier this week from the White House Council of Economic Advisors about one of the big but not often discussed issues in the U.S. job market. Occupational licensing, that is, jobs for which you are required to have a license, government approval, in other words. The report said licensing has gotten way out of hand and that that is hurting the economy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Nivea Earl has been doing African-style hair braiding for the past 16 years.
So it's just kind of like a love and a passion for me.
She decided to open a hair braiding shop in Jacksonville, Arkansas 3 years ago, and soon learned that first she needed to go to school to become a licensed cosmetologist, trained not in braiding, but in cutting, dyeing, and washing hair, even though as a hair braider, she wouldn't do any of those things.
I would have had to go into cosmetology school to pay thousands of dollars for something that they do not even teach.
It's not just hair braiding. States are requiring licenses for more and more jobs. Florists, security guards, even dog trainers can need licenses. Morris Kleiner is an economist at the University of Minnesota and consulted with the White House on its report.
In the 1950s, about 5% of the workforce were licensed at the state level. That number has grown to 25%.
The White House report says the increased licensing requirements drive up prices, and it's harder for workers to move because licensing laws vary from state to state, and states don't recognize each other's licenses. Kleiner says voluntary certification would work better than mandatory licensing. The certification could be done by states or trade associations. Kim Whedon says be careful about that. She teaches sociology at Cornell University.
Some of these organizations are really looking at certification programs as a source of revenue for their organization.
Whedon says there's a whole industry devoted to selling certifications, and nobody's regulating them. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I was in New York City yesterday, as I think I might have mentioned. I went, basically, to get a hamburger. Not just any hamburger, though. Shake Shack is the new thing in high-end burgers and fries. It's been called the anti-chain chain by the New York Times, and since going public back in January, has gotten all kinds of love from Wall Street. Shake Shack has 71 locations now, here and in the Middle East, Moscow and Istanbul, to name just a couple of places. They're on the way to a projected 450 restaurants. So today, on Conversations from the Corner Office, the guy in charge.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
I met up with CEO Randy Garrudy at the very first Shake Shack in Madison Square Park in Manhattan. Had to do the whole experience, of course, which included waiting in the not insubstantial line. It is worth a mention here as we roll this tape that the weather in New York this week has been pretty much disgusting. We'll climb in the line here.
The first thing that we're really lucky today is that it's 95 degrees humid.
And people are still here. That's the bananas part, man.
Well, we manage the line by the tree, right? So we're right now at tree one, two, three, four.
Yeah.
The normal line, if it wasn't 95 and humid, you'd be at fourth tree. And that's
how
you know. This whole thing that we're sitting in front of was a complete and total accident, really and truly.
Which is the best part of this whole story. It started as a hot dog hamburger cart.
It did, but
years
before
ago?
That, we have two fine dining restaurants over there.
Yeah.
11 Madison Park, which is a Michelin 3-star restaurant, and tabla. And we were busy running one-of-a-kind New York's favorite fine dining restaurants. This park, 12, 13, 14 years ago, had really fallen into disrepair. Rats, homeless, drugs. You had to walk around it.
Yeah.
And Danny and a number of neighborhood people created the Madison Square Park Conservancy to help fund the park and renew it. And the first thing they did was an art exhibit called I Heart Taxi. Right here in these on this sand, an artist from Thailand put New York taxis on stilts and said, I want a hot dog cart as a part of this exhibit.
Wow.
So we decided out of 11 Madison Park, Michelin three-star restaurant, we were going to sell some hot dogs, bring them to the hot dog cart. All of a sudden, 50 people lined up, 100 people lined up. The hot dog cart became this unbelievable thing. For 3 years, we ran that hot dog cart as the park started to come back to life.
Yeah.
And the city then came to us and said, why don't we create a little kiosk over here, 400 square feet, and we named it Shake Shack, thinking we'd sell a couple hot dogs. Turns out we added the Shack Burger to the menu. 2004, Shake Shack is born.
How much do you think it helps that the folks running this place, running this company now, had their start in three-star restaurants?
It's a essential part of who we are. We're not just feeding people here. Every one of us had that old roadside burger stand in our hometown.
Right, right.
What was that about? It was about going there with your mom, with your date. It was the community gathering place. That's what Shake Shack gave the world back. And if you look at what fast food did over 50 years, they actually did the opposite, right? They said, we're going to make it as cheap as possible. We're going to make it as uncomfortable as possible. And we're going to ask you to drive through and not even come in. Because that's what's best for us. And we said, hold on.
Should we just step up there?
We should. Let's order.
All right. I am good. I've been told the coffee milkshakes are amazing.
It's great.
So I need one of those.
Sure.
And are you having anything?
Yeah, I'm going to do the new burger. You got the roadside shack?
Fries. A cheese fries.
All right. I think that's it.
Is it hot back there for you? You're doing okay today.
You got any seeing? I'm going to stick my hand in.
All right.
No, it's not bad.
Thank you. Good to see you.
All right. Perfect. I don't know if it was you or Danny Meyer who said, the bigger we get, the smaller we have to act.
Yeah, that,
what does that mean?
That one is mine, and that hangs in my office as a reminder. What that means is big companies are really tempted to make big decisions every time they grow. And, you know, what that means is it's real easy to make decisions for efficiency.
Right.
That's one of my least favorite words in the world. I like effectiveness as a better word. And it means we spend more time thinking about the design that meets that neighborhood. Chain can sometimes be a four-letter word, and the way we've changed that is to say, well, why couldn't every link in the chain make the chain actually stronger and be built for that community, not happen to its community? That's what we've tried to do, and that's what makes a chain of us even stronger every time we add one.
Food's ready.
Oh, we're buzzing.
All right, let's go get the food.
I may have to take a bite if you don't mind.
No, go to town. Go to town. Pay no attention to that microphone in your face. I have been advised that I have to ask you about the French fries. Because you guys, the weak spot here used to be the French fries, right?
This was one of the great...
Fess up to a weak spot.
This is one of the great leadership lessons of my life. So for years, we served crinkle-cut French fries that were frozen. So one day we decide, I think we should do our fries fresh-cut in-house. So we set out to do that. We make the best damn fresh-cut fry you ever had.
They're really good.
But there's more to the story, though.
These aren't them?
Oh, no. So... Fresh cut fries. We're cutting thousands of potatoes by hand all day, every day. Everybody hated them.
Really?
Our fans revolted in the highest order you've ever seen. I just couldn't get my head around agreeing. And I kept saying, no, look, listen, I'm telling you, these are fresh. These are so good. After almost a year of playing around with this, we went back to our frozen crinkle cut fry that you're eating. However, in the process, what was so cool is we took away all those unnatural ingredients, preservatives, colors. Yeah. So now you're eating what Shaq
really
fans have spoken
these,
out.
These are
and
really
said,
good fries.
You got to have these.
Got to say it. The number that's bandied around is 450 stores you guys want. Analysts are like, they're going to grow way bigger than that. Obviously, you get to decide, but what do you make of that disconnect?
Well, we appreciate their confidence in us. What I can tell you is what I've told every investor who said, why can't you do more? Why shouldn't you do? Come on, Chipotle's got 2,000.
Right.
The 450 is not for you. It's for my team. It's for me to say to my team, hey, guys, go get 10 amazing Shake Shacks that will build our brand for the decades to come. Don't go blow it because Wall Street thinks you should do 50.
Randy Garrudy, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
My whole lunch with Randy Garrudi, including the part where I accuse him of stealing my hamburger, is in the next installment of our Corner Office podcast. It is on iTunes, of course, also on our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, in which science once again validates that which you already knew, namely that people walking down the street with their noses buried in their smartphones are a giant pain in the collective patootie. Students at Bath University over in the UK did the research. I saw it in the Huffington Post today. Here's the deal. It's not that people are paying more attention to their phones than where they are going to run into you, right? It's that they slow down. They don't get the heck out of the way of the people who do know where they're going, and so they gum up the whole sidewalk. Mea culpa, by the way, and come on, you do it too, right? Alrighty, gotta go. The Dow Industrial's off about 5 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 17 points, a 3rd percent there. S&P 500 basically flat. Kate Concannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Ryznall. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.